If you notice the screen before services, you may have noticed that I had as a title up there for this lesson, The Patriarchs, and as a text for this lesson, the word Genesis. And some might have looked, well, we talked about Genesis this morning, didn't we? You just preached about Genesis a couple of months ago. Well, we're going to look at Genesis again, but a little more of an overview instead of details in some of the things that we've looked at. We'll go rather quickly over the first few chapters because we have covered those rather thoroughly over the past several months, and we've considered the things that are there. But I want us to look at what may be described as an Old Testament survey sort of thing. And I'm not going to try to get through the whole Old Testament tonight, but if things go as planned, I hope we can get through 2,700 years. And somebody's like, man, I've been in Dan's classes and he can't get through three verses and he's going to get through 2,700 years? Maybe. We'll see. We'll go as far as we can go and then we'll pick up and do the rest of it and work on some more later on. But this 2,700 years that we're talking about is certainly a time period and time frame. When we look at the Bible is divided into three basic sections: the patriarchal age, the Mosaic or Jewish age, and then the Christian dispensation of the New Testament. And the patriarchal age is entirely, almost, contained in the book of Genesis. And when we look at the book of Genesis and the time frame involved, we're looking at about 2,000 years, basically. And if you notice this little text right here, some of you can't read it. It says, all dates are approximate, or an approximation. Approximations, it says. That means we don't know when. But based on some of the timelines that have been developed, these are some reasonable figures to consider. Now, one big question in regard to that is, how long did Adam and Eve live in the garden before they sinned, before they were cast out? I don't know. No way to know. But based on the time frames and how long Adam is said to have lived, we can make some assumptions and some good estimates, as long as we're not wedded to those dates to such a degree that we get into arguments over the fact of whether it was 42:19 or 63:74 or whatever it might be. So we want to look at the things that took place during the patriarchal age. And the first section of that is what's referred to often as the antediluvian period. And it covers the first five chapters of the book of Genesis. And it brings us to the flood. The beginning of that is creation. The end of that, as we see here on the chart, is the flood. And as I stated, we've talked about creation. We talked about the days of creation and the things that were created on the particular days. Day and night divided the permanent, or the firmament, dividing the waters, the dry land and the seas, the plant life, the stars and the seasons and the times and the waters and the animals, or the water animals and the flying animals and then the land animals and man and woman. And we talked about how those things fit together, how creating them in that particular order shows us some things about what God had planned for us and about how these things are needed by the various things that are coming up. And so we're not going to spend a lot of time looking at that, and certainly we all recognize that on the seventh day is a day of rest. God put that into place, and we may mention this morning when we were talking about the Garden of Eden that during that time there wasn't any rain. The ground was watered with a mist. We don't know a whole lot about that time other than what's contained in the first two or three chapters of the book of Genesis. And certainly as we looked at this morning, there's the story of Satan tempting Eve and Eve succumbing to that temptation and Adam taking part in that as well. They sinned against God and therefore were cast out of the Garden of Eden and lost all the blessings they had received. After that, they had children. They had Cain and Abel. We talked about Cain and Abel a little bit this morning, and we're not going to spend a lot of time with them because, for one thing, there's a line of men that we want to keep in mind as we go through the Old Testament study, in particular the book of Genesis. It's a line of men that are very important to the story of Christ. And that line begins with Adam, and the second one in that line is Seth. Now, Seth was born to Adam and Eve after Cain had killed Abel. In fact, he was named Seth because she got him in place of Abel. And he was the beginning of the line that would bring us to Christ. If you look in your Bible, you will find many names mentioned as sidelines or as other people's. But when we follow the pathway of descendants through the Scriptures, it is Seth's line, not Cain's line, not Abel's, not any of the other children that Adam and Eve may have had, but it is Seth who is in the line of Christ. And he was born in Genesis chapter 5 and verse 3 is where we have a record of Adam becoming the father of Seth. And then we go down through that genealogy. And it goes, as we go through that, the end of that chapter, it takes us all the way to a fellow named Noah. And certainly we all recognize Noah and understand him. And what we understand when we look at the timeline, the dates, the lengths of life and such that are mentioned there is some 1,800 years or so has taken place. Now, I've got a chart here, and it's going to be almost impossible for y'all to make out exactly what it says because it's little bitty tiny print even when I blow it up on my computer in order to get all the information there. But this is a chart of the lineage of Noah. And it starts with Adam, and I put some stars here at the important names. Not that these other guys weren't important. There's some good stories about these folks that we need to consider. But these are the four names on this chart that are in the line to Christ that stand out. All of these are in the line to Christ. But I want you to take note of a couple of things. First off, when we look at, and I've got another animation here that'll put a line up there. Take note. This right here is the birth of Noah. Look who was still alive when Noah was born. We think about the time frame of the first five chapters of the book of Genesis, and we think there's 2,000 years there. But understand, Seth was still alive when Noah was born. Adam was still alive when Seth was still alive when Noah's father was born. Adam was still alive when Noah's grandfather, Methuselah, was born. I get confused on these lines because they got names in multiple places and they're small and hard to see. The point I'm making is there were six people, at least, actually seven when you count Enoch, that when Noah was born, had experienced the past. Now think of the stories that you have heard from your father, and maybe even from your grandfather. When Noah was born, he could hear the stories from his, what, great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather? And I mention that because it emphasizes the accuracy of the record. Now, certainly we recognize the book of Genesis was written by Moses, inspired by God. But there are a lot of folks that would come and tell us that it can't be because people weren't alive. They couldn't keep those stories that long. Certainly we see the inspiration of God. But even when we look at what was happening, even by the time of Noah, there were people alive that could have told what happened when Seth was born. Or at least when Seth's son was born. All of these help us to tie these things together. Now, in the days of Noah is the flood. I think I got one more animation here that points out when Noah was born in line with these ones who were born. And notice, Adam's grandson was still alive when Noah was born. Also want us to take note, here's the time of the flood. And that little bitty text up here at the top says 1,656 years from the creation of Adam. That's based on the genealogies and the times listed. And that's how I got my numbers, is subtraction. The time frame there. But 1,659 years, or 56 years since Adam was created, we have the flood. There's a notable person that was still alive when the flood came, besides Noah, and that was Methuselah. And we all know about Methuselah because when we were growing up and going through Bible classes, he's the one that stood out. He's the oldest guy ever. He lived longer than anybody else, except for Enoch, who never died. And Elijah, who, as John pointed out a few Wednesday nights ago, went up into heaven in a chariot of fire, so technically he didn't die either. Methuselah, known as the oldest man ever, was still alive when the flood came. Also, we want to make note that it was during Noah's 600th year that the flood began. 600 years old, second month, and so many days in the life of Noah, and the flood came. All of these things, certainly, a lot of it is more of a trivial nature, but it helps us to tie the stories together. It helps us by knowing this line of men down through here to make the tie from Adam all the way through to Jesus. Well, Matthew thought it mattered, or at least the Spirit, when he told Matthew what to write. Same thing with the book of Luke. They thought it was important. The stories are contained in the book of Genesis because it was important to the people of God of old. It should matter to us. It helps us to tie the stories together. Now, maybe you feel a little better. We've covered 1,600 years already. So maybe we can get through the rest. The next period of time that we have listed here, you notice post-diluvian, and I'm not sure that's an accurate statement. That's what I've got up there. That's what it's usually called. But actually, I would call that the diluvian period because it's during the time of the flood. It starts with the message of Noah in Genesis chapter 6, and it goes through the time of the flood, and then it does follow down through Noah's lineage to the call of Abraham. You'll notice these lines here. Call of Abraham is the end of the post-diluvian period. All of this a part of the patriarchal age. And once again, the times up there are estimates at best. But when we look at the times involved, we see that the time from the call of Abraham to the death of Christ is not very different than the time from the death of Christ to now. We're just over 2,000 years away from the death of Christ today. And the call of Abraham was, what, 2,100 years before the death of Christ? Somewhere in that range. Sometimes when we read through the Bible and we read all of these years, and Methuselah lived for 900 and something years, and this guy lived for 700 and something years, and this guy lived for 800, we begin to think long eons. I don't even remember what an eon is from my history and such, but that's not the case. Just a few thousand years is what we're talking about. The earth, while it may show itself to be very old, it is very young. And knowing these things helps us to understand that and to support that. But what we have here is the story of the flood beginning in Genesis chapter 6. And we know the story of the flood. We know that God looked down and saw that the thoughts and intents of man's heart was only evil continually, except for a fellow named Noah. And Noah was a righteous man, and he did what was right in the sight of God, and he found grace in the eyes of the Lord because of that. And God looked down and said, and he spoke to Noah, and he said, Noah, I want you to build an ark because I'm fixing to destroy the world. Mankind has become utterly evil, and I'm done with them. I'm going to wipe them out. Build you an ark. Here's how you build it. And we won't take the time to go and read the details of that ark. That's for another lesson. That's not a summary. But there are specifics regarding the building of that ark. And it stated at least twice that Noah followed those specifics exactly, following the words of the Lord, and was able to fill that ark with the animals that God brought to him, and he and his family, he, his wife, his three sons and their wives, were all saved in the ark. Now, I'll give you something to look at and consider. What were their wives' names? And I don't want the names of the ones in the movie that was out just a few years ago either, because they're guesses. Noah and his family were saved as a result of the flood and the building of the ark. And that brought us to a new world. In fact, we notice in the New Testament scriptures that the flood is referred to by Peter as a baptism. It was an immersion that brought about a separation from the evil world in the days that Noah was born to the righteous, upright world of Noah and his sons as they began again after the flood. There were changes in the climate. There were changes in the makeup of the earth. There were changes in the people. I want us to look quickly at something here, and once again, this is a guesstimate. It's based on men who have done studies and considered, and I'm not sure where all the details come from making these determinations, but in general, it follows the things that we see contained in the pages of Scripture for Noah and his sons. When the flood was over, certainly we have the story of how Noah sinned, and his son Ham and Canaan sinned as well, and Canaan suffered the consequences by being cursed because of what his father had done. And then we talk about civilization coming up and beginning again. And then we find the Tower of Babel, where all mankind gathered together and said, "Hey, we can work together and we can do great and wonderful things." And God looked down and said, if mankind continues to work together like this, he's going to go just right back to where he was before the flood. And so he confused the language. And the scripture tells us that the confusion of the language, the people spread. And this is an estimate regarding the areas where they spread. Notice Ham, the son of Noah, Ham, went into this area and into the land of Canaan. That makes a difference later on, because all of these names over here that you could see if you were up here as close as I were are mentioned in regards to the ones that were going to be cast out of the land of Canaan by the Israelites. Japheth, his group went to the north and to the east and traveled around through this area, and the descendants of Shem remained in this area. I had some more maps that showed us where Ararat and the Tower of Babel and things like that were, but most of those are estimates and hope that they're close. I think one of the main points we need to gather from this is this little area that is called out in this block right here, and that is the land of Canaan. And look how close it is to the areas that already belong to Shem, but look who it belongs to, Ham. And his descendants, in particular, Canaan is made mention here, the one who was cursed. If you remember when God called Abraham, we're getting on close to where God called Abraham. When God called Abraham, he said, "I want you to go through this land because I'm going to give it to your descendants." And it was the land of Canaan. I thought I could go backwards. The story of Noah and the flood brings us to the time frame of the call of Abraham after the flood, after the Tower of Babel, after mankind has been spread out across the world. And Abram is a man still associated with his father Terah. They are in the regions around about Ur of the Chaldees, over in the west or the eastern side of what we look at as the Fertile Crescent today. Back in the area that most people consider the Garden of Eden to have been located in the very beginning of time. And God calls Abraham and tells him, "I want you to leave where you are and go where I tell you. Now we look at that calling of Abraham and we look at it and count it as important, and it certainly is, but there's a leaving that comes before that. His father left Ur of Chaldees and went to Haran. Terah was the first one that left the civilization and went to the north and to the west into the area around Haran. And it was in Haran that Terah died. Abraham was called by God to leave that area and to go walk through the land of Canaan. And that brings us into this time frame between the call of Abraham and the Egyptian bondage, the time frame of the fathers of Israel. And once again, we want to stop and acknowledge those names that we talked about: Adam, Seth, Noah, and Shem. And now we have Abram, or Abraham, a descendant of Shem. Once again, these things are important because they come to us again when we look at the genealogy of Christ, because they are in direct line with Christ. We need to understand the order, maybe even keep in mind some of the events that took place during the time frame of these men's lives. Certainly, we acknowledge that the lifespan of those before the flood was much greater than the lifespan of those after the flood. But even Abraham lived much longer than most of us live today. But the time frames were shortening. Also want to notice, you may notice here in the big white arrow that's going across there, I got Job with a question mark. As we go through and look at this timeline that I have and some of the events that take place along it, I want us to take note when the various books of the Bible are talking about. Not necessarily when they were written, but the time frame they're talking about. And it's quite possible that the book of Job was written during this time frame of the patriarchs. In fact, most folks think it was during the patriarchs that it was written. But there's no record that says definitely that's when it was. But during this time frame of just a couple of hundred years we have here from the call of Abraham until, as we've got here, the seven-year famine that we talk about in relation to the children of Israel in Egypt, there are three men that stand out. Three men. One, two, three. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The fathers of Israel. And I mention all three because oftentimes when we consider the father of Israel or think about the patriarch, we think of Abraham. But Isaac and Jacob were just as much patriarchs as Abraham was. And we need to keep them in mind as we consider and think about the stories that talk to us in regards to the things that are taking place leading up to the nation of Israel. All of these things that we've looked at from the antediluvian and the diluvian, the post-diluvian, and this time frame is preparing a nation to bring forth the Savior from the beginning of time all the way through. These are the things that Timothy was told by the Apostle Paul to remember and to hold within his mind and to study and to dwell upon and to think about. These things in the prophets and the teachings that his parents, his mother, and his grandmother would have taught him. Certainly, the message and story of Abraham is a continual story from chapter 12 of the book of Genesis. If you count Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, it goes almost all the way to the end of the book, telling the story of Abraham and how his family was brought forth to the land of Egypt. Some things stand out for us. There's the story of Abraham going on his journey into Egypt. And while he's in Egypt, Abraham shows a lack of faith. We think of Abraham as a faithful man. We think of the faith that he had in offering his son Isaac, the faith that he had in following God's call. But he didn't have enough faith to trust in God while he was in Egypt that Pharaoh wouldn't kill him because of his wife. Maybe we don't like to think about that in regards to Abraham because it shows us a weakness, but it's a reminder that all men have failings. And it's a reminder that if we don't put our complete trust in God, we can slip and fall, no matter who we are. Abraham slipped in this. And what we might look at is a small thing in regard to faith, in relation to the offering of your son, the leaving of your home and going to another land. Abraham slipped, and it cost him some. Certainly, we remember that when Abraham left his home, he carried with him not only his wife, but he also carried Lot, his nephew. And there's the story of Lot and how they both prospered in the land of Canaan because of God being with Abraham, and they prospered to such amount that they had to separate. And they ended up going different ways. And there's the story of Lot, how he went after the green grasses of the valley and went toward the land of Sodom because of the riches that were there, because it would be good for his crop or for his herds. And then, of course, the stories of the suffering. And there's some things we need to consider in regard to that. One in particular being that as a result of this, there were two nations born through Lot, through his daughters, that later come to play as the nation of Israel comes back to take over the land of Canaan. Sometimes we wonder, why is there a story about Lot in here in the midst of the story about Abraham? Well, that's why. It tells us of the beginning of those nations, the Moabites and the Ammonites, where they came from and why they might be enemies of the Israelites later on. We have the story of Hagar, who was Sarah's solution to God's promise of an heir of a great nation that would belong to Abraham and to his family, and the failure of that. Because why? It wasn't the plan of God. It was the plan of man. And certainly we can look at the things that take place and the animosity that came between Ishmael and Israel, or Isaac and his descendants, and recognize that there's been great strife throughout all the ages because of that. And it was the plan of man, not the plan of God. There were three promises that were given to Abraham. The land promise, the nation promise, and the seed promise. We need to acknowledge those three promises, and they are certainly important for us to consider as we think about the story of Jesus and how those things were brought about. I want us to also notice that not only were those promises given to Abraham, in particular in Genesis chapter 12, verse 1 through 7, those promises given to Abraham, but they were also given to his son Isaac in Genesis chapter 26, verses 3 through 4. Isaac was given the exact same promises, the land, the nation, and the seed. And then once again, Isaac's son Jacob was given those promises. In Genesis chapter 28, verse 13 through 15, and again in Genesis chapter 35, verse 9 through 12, they're made mention of the land, the nation, and the seed. All three were given those promises, which tells us that that promise passed through that line, and that gives us our last two names in our list. Adam, Seth, Noah, Shem, and then the promises made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And that brings us to what is looked upon as maybe near the close of the patriarchal age, as we get through the life of Isaac and the stories about how they had a son that married from the nation around about and caused great problems, and how the animosity between Esau and Jacob. Certainly one thing that we want to note, when it came time for Isaac to be married, Abraham sent his servant back to his father's people, back to Laban, to find Isaac a son, a wife. And once again, when it came time for Jacob to take a wife, he was sent back to his mother's people, sent back to Laban, the same people there in the land of Haran that Abraham had come from, so that he could find a wife. Maybe we don't think about it that much, but this was a part of separating this nation of people from the rest of the world. Esau married a wife of the land of Canaan. So his lineage was, I hesitate to use the word polluted, but it does fit here, polluted with Canaanites. Ishmael married women from the land of Canaan. And so his lineage was polluted with the Canaanites, not to mention the fact that he was from a bondwoman rather than from Abraham's wife. Jacob, as was Isaac before him, was sent back to the people they had come from Shem, from Shem's people, to find a wife. Keeping these people separated from the rest of the world. Certainly we know the stories of Jacob, how he went to Laban, and he was tricked by Laban into marrying Leah first, and then marrying Rachel. And the stories that are told throughout the scriptures as we continue in the book of Genesis about how his wives plotted to have sons so that they might be the favorite, even though it was obvious through all the things that we read about Jacob that he was in love with Rachel much more than he was with Leah. She was the one he wanted to be a wife. We have the stories of all of those, how those sons were born. There were some instances where they were shamed by the people around because of some events that took place. His sons Simeon and Levi were tainted because of their actions in regards to the events involving their sister. And we see that those things come down to play into their part in the nation of Israel, even later on. But of course, the standout story from the things that happened to the nation, to the children of Jacob, is the story of Joseph and how his brothers betrayed him and sold him. And he went down to the land of Egypt. And certainly, as we note here, the 7 years of famine beginning the time frame of starting the Egyptian bondage. And we look at the things that took place in regards to Jacob and his love for his son and his son's betraying him by sending his son off, selling him off, and telling him he was dead. He goes to Egypt. And we've got the stories of Potiphar and his wife and the baker and the butler in the prison and the things that took place to bring about the rise of Joseph in the land of Egypt. All of these things were for the purpose of fulfilling the promise that had been made to Abraham. Remember, Abraham was told that his people, even though they're going to be a great nation, they're going to rule over the earth for all practical purposes, and they were going to be the deliverer of a seed that would save all of mankind. Abraham was told they're going to be in bondage for 430 years. They're going to suffer enslavement. But when they went down to Egypt, it wasn't to be slaves. They went down to Egypt celebrating, because Joseph was the one that saved Egypt from the famine. Certainly, we remember those stories. We've told them to our children. We even think about them and talk about them as we consider things in our lives today and what's going on in regards to the things that are taking place in our service unto God. We talk about the faith and the trust that Joseph had. And there's the stories of his brothers coming down to get food and going back and him mistreating them to some degree, messing with them, some of us might say. And then when they returned, he revealed himself for who he was. If you recall, his brothers were very apologetic. They were sorry. They were concerned about what Joseph was going to do to get back at them for what they had done. Do you remember what Joseph told them? And this falls into that story that we're looking at of preparing God's people so that Christ could come into the world. Joseph told them, God sent me here to prepare a place for you. They came in as honored guests into the nation of Egypt, and they left as escaping slaves. 400 years they were there, a little over 400 years. During that time frame that we've got listed here up on the board as the Egyptian bondage, beginning with that 7-year famine and ending with the Exodus. And that brings us pretty much to the close of the time of the patriarchs. 2,700 years covered through most of the book of Genesis, certainly. The stories of the Egyptian bondage, the things they had to undergo, the message and story of Moses and how he was sent by God to bring them out of that bondage, the things that Moses had to go through in order to be prepared for that. in some ways an image of what Israel was going to go to in order to be prepared for the great nation that they were to become. All of those things lead us to the time when God brought them out of the land of Egypt. Because now, the time had come for them to take their place in the world. For them to be that great nation that God had promised to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. For them to take over and conquer the land. Certainly. If we go and consider the remainder of the things that are found in the pages of Old Testament Scripture, we follow that story all the way through. At some point, we'll pick back up here with the escape of the Israelites from the land of Egypt and their wanderings in the wilderness, their overcoming the difficulties and problems and conquering the land of Canaan, and their becoming the great and wonderful nation and all the things that go along with that. Once again, this is not a lesson that's presented to really put a focus on the struggles and difficulties we have in this life that we have to overcome. It's not one that tells us we've got to fight against sin, but it is a lesson that reminds us of the connection between who we are today and where it all began. And how that nation of Israel, how the story of the Bible steps down through the ages to bring us to Christ. And the salvation that is found in Him. Certainly, as many of the New Testament writers make reference to, and as we make reference to in our own studies and our own comments and talks, there are images upon images upon images that we find in the Old Testament that talk about things that help us see what we need to know today. One of the great images is the bringing out of the Israelites from the bondage of Egypt. They were slaves. God freed them from that slavery through the law given to Moses. Moses was the one that brought them out through the hand of God. And that imagery is used in the New Testament to emphasize to us how we're slaves to sin, but through Christ, the prophet that was promised to be like Moses, if we listen to him and follow his law, we can be free from that bondage of sin. But certainly, things that we all have heard, grown up studying, it's good for us to go back and be reminded of these connections. And keep in mind that the story of the Bible is the story of Christ and the salvation that is found in Him from the creation of the world to the punishment that is poured out upon the evil nations in the book of Revelation. It's all the story of Christ. How we can find salvation through Him because of the blessing and grace of God acting on our behalf. Put diligently in your own heart and ensure that you're following the laws of Jesus. Those men, Brother John's been talking about the men of faith that are talked about in the book of Hebrews, and we named a few of them this evening as we talked about this. Those men who are listed as men of faith, they're men of faith because they put their trust and hope in God. Were they perfect? No, they fail sometimes. But they pick themselves back up and reach out to God. And as long as they put their trust in God, they receive the blessings God has promised. Certainly, the same will be true of us. If we trust in God, live our lives in accordance with His will, we can receive the blessings that are promised. You find your strength in that. If you're burdened and struggling with overcoming problems in this life that are hindering you from serving the Lord, you're better than you. For you, your subject, won't you come on this thing?